Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
So a lot of people feel overwhelmed and guilty because they don't have it all worked out by the time they're 21. Your 20s are a time when you're deciding what you don't want to be the rest of your life, not what you do want to be the rest of your life. Try it. If you don't like it, get out of it. So hopefully by the time you're 30 years old, you've got more of a feel for it. But most people, the average person, don't have it worked out until they're about 50. The most productive decade of your entire life is your 60s. And so a lot of people feel tremendous relief from that because they've spent so far their first two or three decades feeling guilty and frustrated and angry and driven to change the world already. That's right. Just not realistic.
Welcome to The Aggressive Life. A recent Forbes magazine article from last year found that 76% of people think mentors are important, but only 37% of people have one. That's just one example of our saying-doing gap. I hate that. I hate we say one thing and do something else. It's a matter of passivity instead of aggressiveness. The guy that I've got on today is a guy I've been looking forward to talk for a long, 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 long time. He's actually been a mentor from afar. Dirt, I don't know if you know this. This guy had an impact on me when I was about 25.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, when I was 25, I started doing a deep dive into leadership and what that all means. And he had a couple little books that impacted me then. And then I didn't think about him or hear much from him for literally decades, and a friend of mine turned me on to another book he did recently, and I read it and was like, bam, it was a cool drink of water on a hot day, exactly what I needed to hear right now in my life. His name is Bob Beal. He's been an executive mentor for nearly 50 years, helping leaders clearly define and reach their goals. He's consulted with over 500 companies, including Chick-fil-A, the European Leadership Forum, Young Life, and over 5,000 individual executives. He's got a life that's spent helping others understand how life works. And his newest book, Decade by Decade, is a walk through each stage of life, offering readers wisdom. It's a roadmap for what to expect and what to do. I'm hoping Bob is going to be able to give me some even fresh stuff that he didn't put on that book because I devoured that book. And he's been very helpful to me. So enough of me yapping. Let's get to the good stuff. Welcome to The Aggressive Life, Bob Beal.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, dude.
That's the loudest I've been in 50 years.
Yeah, no question. Bob, 50 years. How old are you, Bob?
I'm 81.
81?
Going on 82.
My gosh. So what were you doing when you were in your, say, 20s?
20s, I was got out of graduate school, went into life insurance for 5 years to make some money to pay school debts, pay for a young family, ended up at World Vision for, I guess, about 6 years. And then started the company, started consulting back when I was just before 30. Mm. And so just been making a way for 50 years. And I've been consulting for now about 50 years.
Wow. So you've interacted with a lot of people in a lot of different sectors. And you've got that, what's it called? Consolidated learning. It's the kind of learning that you only get with years and years and years and years or decades of experience that just helps things crystallize. Maybe it's crystallized learning, whatever it is. So 5,000 executives you've coached. Have you find, is there any common outages with executives or leaders that you coach?
Yes. I thought about that. I've actually had quite a bit of time to think about it. I spent 25 years taking the summer off up at our cottage in Canada. And those are the kind of things we thought a lot about, reflected on, prayed about, et cetera. And there are three common denominators I've found in those 5,000, particularly the presidents, the senior pastors, the executive directors. Number one is a clear, what I call North Star. At the 50,000 foot level, they have a clear understanding of who God is, what their purpose is, what their dream is, what their life work is, and what they want their legacy to be. Those five things comprise what I call the North Star. Secondly, they have a focus over time, over like 30 years. It takes time to build an organization, to grow a company. You can have one degree of refinements, but you don't go from company to company, concept to concept. And then thirdly, an understanding of money management. You can't build an organization. You can't be successful in life without understanding money. And it's a concept, the 10-10-80 rule, where you give 10%, you save or invest 10%, and you live on 80%. A lot of young leaders live on everything they get and give what's left. I say, no, there will never be any left. With lifestyle today, there will never be any left. So those are three things that I've found in common. You have to have a clear big picture. You have to have a focus over a longer period of time. And you have to be able to manage money effectively to be a really successful executive.
I know a number of people who they hear those three things and they either immediately get deflated because they don't have that, or they immediately feel spastic and just start, you know, rushing out. I got to do all these things right now. I got to go, I got to go. Where would somebody start who may hear those and think, is the starting point understanding your North Star and understanding why you would be focused on an organization? Or what is there a starting point? You just got to do all three of them at the same time.
I believe that the North Star is a good starting point. I developed a video on that. It's available on our website that basically helps work you through that. That sort of clarifies if you're 30, 40, 50 years old and still have a clear understanding of that, that says, okay, here's where you start. Here's how you start. You don't know what you really want to do until you have that clear understanding of the big picture. And once you've got that, then and only then can you really begin to develop that longer-term picture.
I interact with younger leaders or younger people, and their North Star, though they wouldn't say it this simply, it might be offensive they said it this way, but basically I pick up from them, their North Star is provide for their family and have a nice life.
Yes.
Is that the kind of North Star? Is that a good enough North Star? Or does it have to be economy sector specific?
No, if you want to just live life and grow old, that's plenty. If you want to just have a good life, that's plenty. If you want to make a difference in the world, if you want to make a significant difference in the world, you have to begin thinking outside of yourself and your own world. And you ask for what the 5,000 executives have in common.
Yeah.
What they have in common is that they have had those three things worked out. Now, let me alert you to this. 20-year-olds rarely have this worked out. Rarely. Most people don't have their thinking really clarified and crystallized until they're at least 40, many till they're 50. So a lot of people feel overwhelmed and guilty because they don't have it all worked out by the time they're 21. In the 20s, one of the things that's really important to see is that your 20s are a time when you're deciding what you don't want to be the rest of your life, not what you do want to be the rest of your life. So you try this and you try this and you try this and you try this, and you say, that I don't want to do that the rest of my life. I don't want to do this the rest of my life. Well, good, get out of it. Try it. If you don't like it, get out of it. So hopefully by the time you're 30 years old, you've got more of a feel for it. But most people, the average person, and actually a lot of the executives that I've worked with, don't have it worked out until they're about 50. Because, and this is a very profound, helpful, really helpful insight to a lot of young executives. The most productive decade of your entire life is your 60s. 60s. I won't be that for 30 years, you know, whatever. I say, yeah, I know that. But your most productive life is actually your 60s. Second most productive life is your 70s. Third most productive life is your 50s.
Wow.
And so a lot of people feel tremendous relief from that because they've spent so far their first two or three decades feeling guilty and frustrated and angry and driven to change the world already. That's right. Just not realistic.
Yeah, that's what really rocked my world. And our mutual friend, Stubby, also Stu Bamek, who's been on the podcast before, he shared me that little soundbite, shared with me that soundbite you mentioned. I read that book and it just came at the right time because I'm 58. So I'm in my third most productive decade, stage for my most productive decade. This sounds so counterintuitive, Bod, because we all feel like, well, we all know our highest amount of virility, our highest amount of energy, our highest amount of maybe optimism, of raw drive is probably in our 20s or 30s. And that's the people we aspire to be like, Mark Zuckerberg or a whomever who's young and made their mark on the world. We think that's the template. So the 60 thing, I mean, where do you get this from? That's just your anecdotal observation or is there something else you're seeing? Or just, I think we would all be really helped and inspired if we had that sort of long vision forecast instead of, wait a minute, more people have followers than me on Instagram right now. Hold on, I'm not making my mark. Where's the 60s thing come from? That, I mean, most people I know who are 60s are, you know, they're trying to play more golf.
Again, I've worked with about 5,000 executives, about 500 presidents. I've spent 50,000 hours one-to-one behind closed doors listening to people who pay me a lot of money, frankly. Mm. And matter of fact, I spent a lot of time with 20-year-olds because of the sons and daughters of my very successful executives. And I hear 20-year-olds, their greatest struggle is survival. Can I survive in the adult world? And so basically, I've just listened to thousands and thousands of hours. And when I've told people what they're going to, you know, what they can expect decade by decade, there's so much relief from it because it gives clarity for their decade and perspective on life. Because if you think about it for just a minute, you're 58. How successful were you at 20?
Not at all.
How successful were you at 30?
Not at all.
How successful were you at 40?
Starting to get there.
Okay, starting to get there.
Yeah.
About 50?
Yeah.
Pretty 50. But I've spent a lot of time with guys like Bill Bright, Jim Kennedy from Evangelism Explosion, Adrian Rogers, Jim Dobson, Josh McDowell. I've spent a lot of hours with men like this. And people say, well, wasn't Dobson or Bill Bright successful in their 50s? I say, sure they were, compared to the average person. But I knew them in their 50s and their 60s and their 70s. And what I began to see is that in their 50s, they were successful. People knew their name, et cetera. But they weren't anywhere compared to the influence they had in their 60s. Hmm. In their 70s, they weren't getting on an airplane as much as they did in their 60s. But they were, their thinking was more mature.
Yes.
They had an understanding of life, how all the thoughts come together, and their ability to think through various issues and lead people in strategic directions was still very, very, very strong in their 70s. And so as I've spent time with, I don't know how many thousands of people, in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, I say the reality is that given health, if you stay healthy, you're just beginning to see where you will be 10 years from now. And what you're going to find is that your 60s, I'm sorry, your 50s, 58, is the final decade to get ready to maximize your 60s. So what you're asking yourself right now is, in the next 2 years, where do I need to grow or what do I need to do or become to be ready to absolutely maximize my 60s? Is the question that I think you're asking.
Bob, this is so good. My favorite topic to talk about is me. That's my favorite topic. And you say people pay you a lot of money. So I'm really struck by, okay, I got you for, I don't know, 45 more minutes or whatever. I'm struck to just have a personal counseling with you because I don't have to pay you anything because you're on my podcast. I'm also
you'll get my invoice later.
Right. I would. I'm also thinking we probably need to get off the podcast and I need to just hire you because you're ringing my bell big. So we're going to get back to me in a little bit because, again, I like talking about me and I'm in the 50s and 50s. You're really hitting me. But let's go back and give a rundown of 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70. Everybody in the aggressive life is in one of those decades. I guess we got some teenagers in there, but you know they'll get to 20s at some point. So give us your little cliff notes without ruining the book for us. It's a great read. No matter what you say, I recommend getting the book. It's a short but really profound read. I marked the whole thing up through and through. So just take us through it. Like your 20s. What's life about in your 20s?
Let me start with the 20s. You often have children. From 0 to 10, our greatest need, I'll give you an S word for each decade. It'll help you remember it a little bit better, maybe.
Good.
What children need is security. And that comes from being unconditionally loved. Your children that you have and grandchildren need security. Your teens are often about yourself. You're becoming aware of what. And so teenagers have this self-awareness or self-centeredness that you need to take them on a mission trip. If you got teenagers, take them on a mission trip where they can see that they're not the only ones that don't have 78 pair of shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Our 20s, the word is survival. But what that means is survival in the adult world. Can I survive in the adult world? I've got clients and children in their 20s who graduated Harvard, Yale, Berkeley. And I say, does the word survival hit with you emotionally? Oh, does it ever? And I say, what you're wondering is, how can I survive in the adult world? I've been in a structured academia, but do I know how to buy a car? Do I know how to build a house? Do I know how to, you know? And people ask me all the time, what are you going to do with your life? I have to tell them, well, I think I'm going to be a doctor or something, but I have no clue. I say, you're not supposed to have a clue what you're going to do the rest of your life in your 20s. That's a time when you're trying a variety of things. And that's so much relief to 20-year-olds. Your 30s yes. is success. You're driven to become successful. And you're climbing this slippery pole called success. When I ask people in their 30s, do you have a clear definition of success? I guess not. They're climbing a slippery pole. They don't even know what it is. And what it is, success is simply having what you want and wanting what you have. So the person
like that
has that wants 100,000 a year and has 101,000 a year feels far more successful than the person that wants to make $1 million a year and is only making 900,000.
Yeah.
It isn't a reality. There is no reality called success. It's simply a feeling. I feel like I'm successful. Mm. By the way, in your 30s, one of the most powerful things you want to find is a mentor that can accelerate your success in the direction you want to go. Your 40s, 37 to 43, you began shifting your focus from success to significance. And you began saying, I know I'm successful, but is it making any difference in the world? Am I making any difference in life? You're beginning to think about eternity. And the struggle, that's until you get about 45 typically. But when you get 45 to 50, I've asked a lot of executives in their 60s, 70s, what was the most difficult section of your life? Very rarely do they answer anything but 45 to 50. That's where you have the most heart attacks, affairs, et cetera.
Interesting.
The kids are all getting up, grown up, and teenagers asking questions you don't want to ask. Your mate is taking care of all kinds of things. You're being pulled in 15 directions. You're growing in your profession. It's like that is the toughest section of life is 45 to 50. But when it feels like you're running through, you're a racehorse running through 6 inches of mud, 45 to 50. But when you hit 50, the track begins to dry out. It's like you hit your stride. S word for 50 is a stride. But I have yet to talk to a 50 to 53-year-old that hasn't felt over the hill. Anyone listening to us that's 50 to 53 will recognize what we're talking about. Here's why. It's because, first of all, you're not 35. You don't have that same amount of natural energy you had at 35.
Right.
Not really the reason. The real reason is you're looking at life wrong without the right perspective. What you're looking at is life is uphill till 50 and then downhill toward 100. So when you hit 50, you think, I'm on my way downhill. I'm going toward 100. That's not the way to look at it. The way to look at it is my most productive decade is my 60s. So my 50s are not when I'm over the hill. It's getting ready to maximize my 60s. The second most productive decade is my 70s. Therefore, the next 30 years are the most productive years of my life instead of I'm over the hill. Your 60s, and so your 50s, the question is, how do I grow? Where do I want to grow? Where do I want to be when I'm 60 years old so that I can absolutely maximize the 60s? Your 60s, the S word, is strategic. You know you're successful. You know you're productive. But you're asking yourself the question, I know I'm successful, but is what I'm doing really making any eternal difference? What's the most strategic thing I can do right now to make the most strategic difference with my life? It's your most productive decade. Your 70s, the S word is succession. Because they think, I built all this up. I built this church. I built this company. I built this organization. It's going great. I'm in my, just gotten out of my 60. It is going great. The question is there anyone in place to take it over when I'm gone? Have I got people ready? Is anyone ready? Is my son ready? My daughter ready? Is my staff? Who's ready to take it over? How do I get them ready? Succession becomes an obsession. 80s becomes the word I use is slippery. Health becomes an issue often. It seems like you go to the doctor every other week. And the biggest thing I have for someone in their 80s, there is a societal demand that you retire at 65.
Yep.
Don't do it. If you leave your work between 65 and 80, never use the word retirement. Use the word semi-retirement. Because at 60, or at when you're retired, society thinks of you as no longer value. I'm no longer a value at all. Out of date, out of touch. No, just not worth anything, just living off their pension.
Yeah.
When you're semi-retired, society thinks of you as wealthy enough to do what you want to do.
Yep.
Total difference in perception. In your 90s, the S word is sleep. Now, your audience may not be in their 90s, but their parents may be, their grandparents may be. So the question is, what you're going to find is that when you go to visit your grandpa, your grandma, your mom, or your dad, they basically want to go to sleep and not wake up. They don't want to have suffering of cancer and pain like they've seen some of their peers.
Right.
And that's where, if they are not believers in Jesus, you want to read them the 90 section, which shows how to know you're going to heaven when you die. It's been a great relief for people to understand how to know they're going to heaven when they die. And so that's a quick overview of the book. And life is shockingly predictable. Again, given health, the one variable is health. That's why you want to take care of your health. That's why it isn't an obsession to be bulky or whatever, may not be significant. But the desire to be healthy is a significant variable in life because it allows you to live longer.
Man, I was just, Dirt and I were just talking earlier today about mentors that I have, and you know, I've gotten to a place in my life where there's not as many viable candidates as when I was 30 or 40. You know, there's just fewer people who are faithful for decades and decades, or people that for whatever reason you just pass up, or just Or there's a lack of a one-stop shop, somebody who can kind of mentor you in everything. You're a rare dude. So I'll tell you right now, I don't know what your exorbitant price that you charge is, but I'm going to hire you.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I know enough to make an aggressive move and say, you and I got to find out your fee. I just want to do that. You're a person I want to have you build into me more. So thank you. A little bit of my life. And I'll just allow the listener of my podcast just to process through how I think through things. When I was 30, I had a crisis, an identity crisis, because when I turned 30, I realized I'm not a young leader anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're a young leader, there's a whole bunch of things that go along with it. I can make mistakes. My best days are ahead of me. All that. And then when you're 30, you go, oh man. I guess I'm not a young leader anymore. At least I didn't look at it that way. No, when I was 40, another crisis birthday, because I thought, dang, man, this is like prime time. This is supposed to be when I make hay. I don't know if I'm doing that or not. Oh my gosh, there's no more staging. It's game time. Like, these are the critical ones, right? And then when I turned 50, and I'm listening to myself, I guess I'm more negative than I thought. I looked at these milestone birthdays as negative. I didn't feel that coming up to them, but like when I hit them, that's how I felt. And when I hit 50, I thought, my gosh, my 40s were a blink. I'm going to be 60 and gumming my cream of wheat before I know it. It's like almost over. I've got
your best 22 years are right ahead of you. And by the way, it's not only, well, every decade is a shocking reality. When we hit those decadal markers, that's why I wrote the book Decade by Decade, because when you're 23 or 24, it isn't that big a deal. You like a cake and candles. But when you turn 30, when you turn 40, when you turn 50, you don't know quite what to expect of this next phase of life. And that's why one of the reliefs in the book is that it explains what is normal for my life right now. Because people say, I'm 40. What's normal for 40? And one of the things you're going to find is that the wives in your church or in your acquaintance, wives feel more pressure than husbands do it at certain times in their 40s. They feel like, we're 40. I'm 40. My husband is 40. Our children are getting older. We don't have the big house. We don't have the Mercedes-Benz or the Bentley or whatever. And they feel like we're over the hill. And the reality is, when wives realize, and husbands realize, but it's especially a relief to wives, I find, when they realize that by their 40s, we're not supposed to be quite there yet, I watch them breathe a deep sigh of relief. If I say, look, in your 40s, couple, if you can just pay your rent and pay your mortgage and pay for your car loans and keep your kids in school and have $1 left at the end of the year, you are in great shape. You're better than most of the people in this world.
Yeah.
And then there's another phrase that's really important right here, and that is phase of life. Each of these are a phase of life. And you tell people in their 40s, look, you're in a phase of life. This is not life. This is simply a phase of life. When your children are still in high school, when you've got all these payments, you're going everywhere all the time. That's one phase of life, but that's not the way life will be the rest of your life.
Right.
Great relief.
That's strong. Is this part of the generational divide that we have in our country and have probably always had, that it's not so much the people in their 20s are so different from the 50s, it's just that they're in their 20s and other people in their 50s. Do these decades relate to our intergenerational, how we play with one another?
I think the big issue there, Brian, is the health issue. I think 50 years ago, when you were 20, you expected to live another 10 years. Today, we expect to live to be 100 or 90 or something. And so the discussion becomes different. But I think it's just because of the health issues, because people in their 20s have rarely been on top of the world in any decade. Again, the variable is health. And given health, I think the 20s are the 20s, the 50s are the 50s.
It is true that, you know, your North Star idea, I read that more as, you know, my guiding vision for my life instead of just my moral compass. That's how I hear that. And, you know, when we're 20, at least when I was 20, I was basically told that the dream and the expectation was to be retired at 55.
Yeah.
And that's what it was. And then you get to be 55 and you feel like, gosh, I feel like I'm just getting warmed up. So I reset my date at 70. This is just about me. Again, my favorite topic is me. So I reset my date at 70. I named somebody else lead pastor who reports to me, Kyle Rance, an amazing guy. He's doing a lot of the creative grunt work and a lot of the stuff in the organization that I was doing before. Really, just solid, 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 solid. And now I'm even wondering, like, my life is so much more full and, quite frankly, easier with him on deck, with him in the bridge, rather. Now I'm going, maybe I shouldn't have said 70. But you said, because you said you should never retire. Like, what are you telling me? You tell me, like, not just me, but what about the person in corporate America? They're going to be pushed out. So talk more about what it means to have an attitude or belief that you're not going to retire. What would life look like?
And that's why I'm saying that it's into semi-retirement.
Okay.
You're getting to do what you want to do. One of the first things you need to try to figure out as soon as you possibly can is, of all the things I do well, what is my unique single greatest strength? By the time you're a leader in our society, and most people don't even necessarily want to be leaders, but by the time you're a leader in our society, we have 10 things we do better than most people, or we probably wouldn't be a leader. But the question becomes not what are the 10 things we do best as a leader, but it's of all the 10 things, what are the top three things? And then of the top three things, what's the number one thing I do the very best?
Yeah.
And then run that past two or three of your close friends and say, yeah, of all the things I do well, or of all the things I do, what do you see me doing best? And see if there's an alignment there. And when you can get alignment between your three friends and yourself as to what you do best, then spend the rest of your life trying to figure out, how do I maximize that? The reality is that you may have by the time you are 80, you may find that your 50s were the first gear of your life.
Yeah.
And your 60s are second gear, your 70s are your third gear. A lot of people they can't imagine life getting a whole lot better when they're 58.
Right.
Top of the heap, they think. But it's the top of the heap that they have thought of at the moment.
Right.
But something else occurs, and all of a sudden, there is a whole new option out there. We put artificial limits on us way too fast. And that's society. Again, society has pressured us to retire at 55 or 65. And if you retire at 55, you're going to be bored silly.
Taking care of your health isn't always easy, but it should be at least simple. That's why for the last 2 years, I've been drinking AG1 every day, no exceptions, at home, on a hunting trip, camping off my motorcycle, no exceptions. It's just one scoop mixed in water once a day, every day, and it makes me feel ready to get moving. That's because each serving of AG1 delivers my daily dose of vitamins, minerals, pre and probiotics, and more. It's a powerful, healthy habit that's also powerfully simple. I like to have it in the morning. I have a 12 ounce of water, so right off the bat, I'm helping my hydration every single morning. This is the one product, if I had to recommend one, I'd recommend this one to elevate your health. It's AG1, and that's why I partnered with them for 2 years. So if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and five free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/aggressivelife. That's drinkag1.com/aggressivelife. Get yourself some. I agree with you, but on the other side of the equation, I see, and just in my industry, I'm talking the pastor industry, which, Derek, we've always said this is not a faith podcast, it's not a pastor podcast, but recently I've been talking a lot about these things.
That's true.
I know, so.
It's a big part of who you are.
Yeah, right. And we've always said it's about me.
That's right.
It's my podcast, and I'll do what I want to, do what I want to. You would do it too if you had your own podcast, but I've seen in my sector, dudes are phoning it in at 55. They're not taking big risks at 55. They're not increasing their mortgage to reach more people at 55. They're winding down internally without trying to have anybody notice that they're winding down. Their best creative ideas were a while ago. That's what I see.
And the reality is it's because they feel over the hill.
So if they didn't feel that, they wouldn't be that way. But you're saying they have a self-fulfilling prophecy that they're living out.
That's exactly right. All of our behavior is based on our assumptions.
Hmm.
Everything you do is based on the assumptions you're making. If you are assuming that you're dumb, you act and react like you're dumb. If you assume you're smart, you act like that. If you assume that you can't do anything, you don't do anything. But if you're assuming that you're at 50, you're over the hill because you don't feel like you're 35 physically, you're going to start winding down, hoping people don't see it.
Yeah.
You get to be 50 and you say, wait a minute, I'm just getting ready to be 60. You're going to begin defining, where do I want to be at 60? How do I want to maximize my 60s? And how do I absolutely get to where my 70s are some of the most productive decades I've got? Look at the number of governors, senators, mayors, et cetera, who are in their 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s, some 80s. It's like, did they retire when they were 50? No. They may have semi-retired, but they're just getting started.
Yeah, that's very true.
By the way, Peter Drucker was a large influence on my life. I just spent 2 days with Peter. I didn't spend days and days and days. But one of the things he said during those 2 days was—
Wait, you spent 2 days with him? He's dead. You spent 2 days with him recently? Are you doing seances?
2 days in the 90s.
Okay, all right.
No. In the 90s. I should have clarified that.
Yeah.
And one of the things he taught was— last year's unexpected success is next year's opportunity. And before I could, I wrote it down, but before I could go sit in the corner and think about that for an hour, he said, but staff will always, underline always, resist the change required to take full advantage of the opportunity.
Mm.
And I wanted to go sit for another hour.
Right.
And it was like, that blew my head off. I've changed it a little bit to the past's unexpected success is the future's opportunity. So when you're 58 years old—
And staff yourself, will always resist it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Always unexpectedly successful in the last year or so.
Yeah.
And why am I and my staff resisting just letting it blow out the tube? Why are we resisting just letting it explode? And so then the first question is, what was unexpectedly successful? You say, well, maybe not that much. I say, but what was anything that was unexpectedly successful in any business or organization? Why are we resisting letting it grow? Number three, what is the regional potential of it? Would this be the whole 4 or 5 state regions surrounding us? How could we expand that men's program, that children's program, that youth program? How could we let that grow and to teach it other region? Number four, what's the national potential of it? Any idea we've got that surprised us by how well it did? And number five, what's the global potential over the next 50 years?
Right.
I say, asking a few of those kind of questions just opens up your mind in terms of what is the potential? Because every organization has potential that we're not using right now.
Bob, I've asked a question of a number of people, and it's been a rhetorical question because I haven't expected anybody to have the answer. But you might. You might actually. Here's my rant. You mentioned one of the people you mentored or consulted with many years ago, Bill Bright, who, for our listeners, Bill Bright started and led one of the greatest movements in the history of America. It was called Campus Crusade for Christ, kind of a socially awkward term because most people aren't into the Crusades, but nonetheless, an aggressive thing where he recruited staff members for, I think, every single university in the entire nation who raised their own support, looked to him for leadership and inspiration, and then went and shared Christ on those campuses. I mean, crazy, crazy, crazy. Started this thing called the Four Spiritual Laws. There was a way to walk people through understanding who Jesus was and how you might get to heaven. There was guys like him. There was guys like Jim Rayburn, who started Young Life, most dynamic organization that ever reached high school students in our nation's history. Started camps, took people to Colorado and Malibu, hyper-million-dollar properties he just prayed for and went into debt for and raised money for and shipping. I had a bus company that would bus kids from all over the country to these camps. It was crazy. So here's my all this background. Here's my question for you, Bob. I keep wondering, why do we have no Bill Brights, Jim Rayburns, whomever today? It's like everybody's trying to be the latest version of a mega church pastor with a YouTube worship band that has 2 million views. Everyone's trying to get a book deal. Everybody's trying to like follow the quote unquote successful thing. But all these people who did great things before, they didn't follow the successful thing. They did a one-off vision and it changed future generations. I don't see anybody doing that. Why is that?
Well, first of all, you don't see everyone that's out there.
Okay.
There are some guys like that that are doing things that are so small right now. They may be in Connecticut or Florida or somewhere. Huh. We don't see all of those. And they are sort of developing because at some point, no one knew about Campus Crusade or McDonald's hamburgers. You know, that's where I say it takes time. It takes 4 years just to get something up and going, really. It takes 10 years to get it established. It takes 15 years to be an overnight sensation. And it takes about 30 years to get it where it'll go beyond the founding leader. And so it just takes, like I say, it takes unique strength, takes unique vision, it takes that North Star, but it also takes time to develop over time. And so what you're really not seeing is all the guys that are in their first year or two or three or four or five that are planting organizations right today that will grow into being a crew or being a Young Life or being something 30, 40 years from now.
Okay. I hope you're right. Just to push back on you, Then I would have expected those 20 or 30 year olds 30 years ago to have things that would have flowered by now. And that's not happening. There should still be new, fruitful works that are beyond worship bands and mega churches.
I hear you. And so let's say, for example, you're right that there aren't any. I think there was a period of history where there were no mentors to.
Interesting.
There was a period of history from about 1960 when I was growing up till about 1990 or so, when there was a lot of discipleship, but no mentoring. Discipleship is teaching the four laws, and mentoring is helping a relationship in which their person is helping the person realize their God-given potential over time. Those are two very different concepts. And when I was growing up, there was very little mentoring. There was a lot of discipling, but very little mentoring and encouragement like that. another thing is that there are seasons of life for some reason where, like, for example, I knew Bob Pierce, who started World Vision.
Amazing.
I've met Billy Graham. I've just met Jim Kennedy, who started Evangelism Explosion. I worked with him. I worked with these people. And they tended to know each other. And they tended to encourage each other. I think the thing that happened in the early 80s was that the people who were encouraging each other were encouraging each other to start mega churches and then to start branch churches model.
Yes.
But I think in about the year 2000, I began to see I'd hate to say a lostness, but there were very few new models out there. There was sort of where do we go from here? Everybody had sort of a clear idea of what they're going to do till the year 2000. But beyond that, again, you can go decade by decade. In the 50s, this was happening. In the 60s, this was happening. In the 70s, this was happening. Because in the 50s, it was the organizations. In the 60s, it was the larger churches. In the 70s, it was the mega churches. In the 80s, it was like the branch churches. And each decade has a thing, the new model.
Right.
But I found it difficult to spot the new model starting at about the year 2000. And I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a good point of, I hear you talking about peer groups that encourage one another. I think you're right, Bob. I think that we are finding peer groups that are doing the same thing we do and encouraging one another. But we don't have peer groups of people who are doing a new thing, a new wineskin. I just got done with my first cohort of pastors. It's a monthly Zoom call I've done with them for, I don't know what it was, 7-8 months. And then I have a personal phone call with them once a month. And then we have text threads going. It was really cool. And in many respects, they all would love to have and grow their church to, you know, the size that Crossroads is and all that stuff, which I don't blame them. That's good to have models to look for. But one of the things I pushed them on was, what is your vision? Paul says that to Timothy. You know, he says, be sober-minded, endure hardship, do the work of evangelism, and fulfill your ministry. What is your ministry? That means, what are you only in class in? Not fulfilling the ministry of some other pastor or my ministry, but what is the thing where you're only in class? Because that's when it's a vision. If it's not only in class, you're just trying to have best practices, which is different, which is fine. It's all best practices. But we need people who are fulfilling their ministry, have only in class visions, like a one-off. And you may be on it. We need to get the one-off people in rooms together where they can encourage each other and go higher and higher instead of just megachurch pastors who want to open up another campus.
There are two or three things that I have seen in the last nearly 25 years. In the 2000s, I think the church, from my perspective, sort of lost its way, lost its focus. But what didn't was the lay people found their focus in groups like C12, and there are a variety of other groups that are men's groups that have formed up and are growing into their potential. And I think you mentioned camps. There's a difference between launch and grow. In other words, let's say, for example, with World Vision, when I went there in 1968 or 69 or somewhere back in there, when I got there, they were only $10 million globally. I told them they were thinking too small. I was 28, upstart, rash kid. I said, Stan Winium said, well, how big do you think we should be? I said, well, in 5 years, 50 million, 10 years, 100 million. He laughed right out loud because he couldn't see quite how to take something that existed and bring it into its potential. And, but at 5 years, they were 48 million. And at 10 years, they were 101 million. I'm saying it takes a different person.
And today they're a billion something? What are they today? They're way up.
Today, they're 2 billion. And they are 1 billion U.S. and 1 billion globally.
Wow.
But what I'm really saying here is that a lot of what you're pointing out is absolutely accurate, that there aren't founders, startup, launch people in place maybe. But I think we're in a phase where people have taken things like World Vision and Young Life, et cetera, they've taken it from launch under 10 million to 80 million, 100 million, a billion. And that's been a phase of development for Christian leadership how do I take something that exists and take it to times 10?
So what's the, I'm going down the rabbit hole here. There's probably a small percentage of our population who's interested in this, but I don't care. I'm interested in it. So what's the difference with World Vision and Young Life and Crew? Because Young Life and Crew, their best days are way behind them, like way. But World Vision has kept going up and to the right. What's the difference?
The difference is always leadership from my perspective. I don't want to speak poorly of any organization, but basically, if the board doesn't choose the right leader, it can really mess up in a hurry. But if the board has the ability to choose the right leader, it can keep growing on and on and on. It's a matter of leadership. In a single word, it's leadership. And World Vision has had some of the finest leadership.
Yeah.
It's also, well, I'll let it sit there.
Is it if the board doesn't choose the right leader or if the leader doesn't have the right successor? What's the interplay between the board and the leader?
Both are true. You got to put your finger on a good point. But it isn't the leader's job to choose their successor. It's the leader's job to suggest or recommend their successor. But it's the board of directors' job to choose the leader. And boards are historically really, really poor at that. It's a very rare board that has a clue as to what the executive director, the senior pastor, the president actually does on a day-to-day basis. And so is it any wonder the first successor they choose to the founder fails within a year or two? Is it any wonder the next director fails within a year or two? Is it any wonder that 30 years later, it isn't what it could have been? Hmm. I say, but if you are the board of a World Vision and you choose, when you're starting out, you can afford to have someone that you pay, and this is true of General Motors, Quaker Oats, or whoever, you can afford to pay a senior executive X number of dollars. When you're in phase two, you could afford to pay him more and get a little bit higher level experience et cetera. On the phase three, you could afford to pay him a substantial amount and get a major executive to come in and really take it to the next phase. But when board of directors don't have the ability to see what they really need or have the desire to pay a nonprofit leader what the nonprofit leader could get at General Motors, often it just they get someone who is not the right person to be the president of the organization or the senior pastor or the whatever, the head coach. As you know from listening to sports, coaches make a lot of money because they win games. And a lot of times a board doesn't understand that a nonprofit leader, to relate to society as they need to relate to it, is worth quite a bit of money. And so they keep trying to pay what they paid the first one, the founder, and they can't get anyone for that. I'm off on a rabbit trail here, but I'm saying it's leadership. And the board often doesn't have a clue what he does. He doesn't have a clue how to replace him. And so they don't replace him with the right person. So that board, having the right board in place and having that board oriented as to how to choose the right leader is absolutely fundamental, absolutely fundamental.
Well, the board often does think that they have a clue, and oftentimes the board doesn't have a clue.
Yes,
you got a guy who's got a person who is overseeing a large staff, and you got people who don't oversee any staff. You know, you've got a school teacher, God bless school teachers, but they can't identify much and never felt the burden of putting food on the table of hundreds of staff members. And leading an organization, it's theory, it's philosophy. They've never actually done that. It's a different deal, you know.
And just that leadership is the absolute key to gear shifting, next step, next phase. And what you're going to find is that every organization that has continued to grow has continued to have the ability to choose the right person for the next phase of the organization's development. And often that person, one of the mistakes they often make is choosing a 35-year-old to lead an organization because of energy. We need a young person because of their energy to lead this church that's five times bigger than they've ever led the organization. And I've seen it fail time after time.
Let's end with this, Bob. This has been so good. You've basically been mentoring me. So just wrap this up with these basic questions. Put them together in any form that you want. How do I find and utilize a mentor? And then if I am a mentor, what should I be doing for the people who look to me to be a mentor?
All right. How you find them, first of all, is you look for, let me define mentoring first. Ideally, and not all mentoring relationships are ideal, but ideally, mentoring is a lifelong relationship in which the mentor helps the protege realize her or his God-given potential. That's what mentoring is, as defined in my book on mentoring. But since it's a relationship, it's like a marriage to an extent. And so when you're looking for a mentor, you want to get together with them personally. And you say, well, I've read a book, and I read Bob Beal's book, and he's my mentor. I say, no, he's your teacher. He's he's an author, but he's not your mentor. Mentoring is a relationship with a person. So you get together, first of all, with the person that you admire and respect, and you have some kind of access to. You get together for a cup of coffee, a lunch, a dinner, however you want to, and see what the natural chemistry is, the relational chemistry, and see if you could see, and if you think they could see, growing old together, so to speak, and that they have experiences and abilities you have never even thought of having, that over time you could get together again and again, and one day say, would you ever consider being one of my life mentors? And then lock it in a little bit tighter. But that's how you find a mentor.
Awesome. And then if you are a mentor, how do you make the biggest splash positively in somebody else's life?
Well, first of all, I think you help them define their single greatest strength.
Yeah, I wrote that down. That was a great word.
And how to maximize that strength. Because Peter Drucker, one of his principles that he taught me was the role of an organization is to maximize the strength of the individual and make their weakness irrelevant. A mentor has to believe in the person. They have to believe in that person's ability. And so you choose wisely who your proteges will be. I have a hopefully quick story, and it goes like this. I want you to imagine something. I want you to imagine for a minute that it's 1946, and you're rolling through Tupelo, Mississippi, and you haven't been to church, and you want to go to church that night. And so you say to your wife, let's stop by here and go to church at 2500, little junior high choir. Choir sings, preacher preaches. Afterwards, you go to the choir director. You say, hey, that little boy back there has a tremendous amount of ability. And you should let him sing a solo occasionally. Oh, no, Zingo sings all of our solos. Let him stand out. No, I treat everyone the same. You say, sir, you're not listening to me. That little boy right back there, Elvis Presley, will someday sell more records than anyone but a group out of England called the Beatles. Interesting little, cute little story. The question is, who is the Elvis in your world?
Oh, that's great.
Who is the Elvis in my world? And then how do I mentor them into their full potential?
Bob, that's fantastic. Bob, if someone wants to dig into your work, just give an advertisement of yourself. Where do we find you? On the web, social media, your books? Lay it on us.
All right. Well, thank you. I have three websites, actually. One is just Bob Biehl, but it's BOBBBIEHL.com. That's where you find all of our tools, 50-some tools, et cetera. We have one called QuickWisdom.com. That is a weekly bit of wisdom, principles to strengthen you in life. It's free. Just go to QuickWisdom.com and sign up. The third is SeedPlantingTeam.life. It's where we talk about decade by decade. If you want to buy one, they're $20 through BobBiehl.com. But if you want to give them out, they're 10 for $20, $2 a piece.
Yeah.
You're giving them to people to, as a way, an option to let them know they're going to heaven when they die.
Bob, this has been rich. You and I will be in touch again after this. Thanks for making a deposit in our life. Hey, folks, do something. Make an aggressive move. Whether you're 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, there's something you can do to push your life forward. You're in the right place. Go forward. We'll see you next time on The Aggressive Life. Thanks for joining us on this journey toward aggressive living. Find more resources, articles, past episodes, and live events over at briantome.com. My new books, a repackaged edition of The 5 Marks of a Man, and a brand new 5 Marks of a Man tactical guide are open right now on Amazon. If you haven't yet, leave this podcast a rating and review. It really helps get the show in front of new listeners. And if you want to connect, find me on Instagram at Brian Tome. The Aggressive Life is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.